Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, Intel CEO steps down, NFC car keys are coming for smartphones, it's going to be a good year for gaming laptops, and how would you like 19 gigabyte per second transfer speeds? All that more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 471, recorded on June 21st, 2018. Intel's new meltdown problem, management. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/twit. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most delightful, most engaging, most informative, and occasionally even the most peculiar news in PC hardware. We love the phones, we love the mobile, we love the consoles, we love the hardware, we love the Internet of Things, except when we don't. Today, ladies and gentlemen, we love the mangling editor-at-large of PCPer.com, Josh Walrath, who is in for Mr. Ryan Schrout, who is off on what I will affectionately call an extraordinary basketball adventure today.
If only we had such adventures. Instead, my adventure is appearing here.
I'm happy that he's getting to go to do this, because going to see the draft picks would be completely wasted on me. Incredibly talented
care.
Basketball guy. But he seemed almost... Ryan's not the type of person that implies giddiness while typing in emails, but I felt giddiness from his email.
Yeah, the older he gets, the more he into basketball he is certainly becoming.
So
he bleeds blue with that damn Kentucky.
And I guess he's actually traveling with a small group of people with the head coach from Kentucky to go attend this little shindig. So hopefully he eats well while he's in New York. That's all I got to say. Korean barbecue at 2 a.m. Oh, my goodness. Weird announcements this morning, kind of out of nowhere. We've been talking about Intel a lot lately for obvious reasons. They're falling behind on process. What happened with the 8086? What's going on with next generation processors? Boy, are those AMD Ryzen processors fast. Boy, are those AMD Ryzen processors fast and cheap. Jay, you remember when Intel was going to be a leader in do you remember when? So it's been a messy couple of years for Intel, to say the least. And that's not even getting into Meltdown and Spectre, not Melter, although Melter does sound kind of good. Then there was the issues with, Brian Krzanich. You could say there's been some leadership issues, some direction issues, some issues maybe formulating a long-term plan to fight off the threat, if you will, of ARM processing. Sure, he dumped $39 million in stock before the massive meltdown and Spectre flaws were publicly known. But that wasn't insider trading, just a coincidence. So he's finally resigned, of all things, over a relationship with an employee, which is against the rules at Intel. I got to ask you,
fraternization.
Which on one level I get, because one of the first large media companies I worked at was very unusual in that they actually had a whole – there was a news – this was back when they still did like newsletters. There was a whole section of the newsletter that was about people who had gotten engaged or married who all worked at the company, which was, I thought, really surreal. I get non-fraternization policies. Don't date where you work. There's another earthier version of that phrase you may be thinking of right now as a listener.
Yes.
This just seems like this is not a case of nobody's claiming that this was harassment. Nobody's claiming that this was unwanted. It was consensual. Both parties were down with it. It was just against the rules. And it's become known, and now Krzanich is resigned. Does this reek of a convenient way to have him exit stage right while they look for new leadership?
Well, you know, I guess two things on that. One, usually a lot of sometimes this fraternization thing can be overlooked because, hey, this person is in a different section. They don't report to anybody else, and there's no, you know, superiority, inferior type relationship. But everybody is inferior to Brian. And so, yes, that would be very inappropriate. And two, yeah, it is very convenient because if you've looked at Intel in the past 40 years, when they've had strong competition, their business has done great because they've always risen to meet the challenge. And if you look when the competition, such as like when the original Athlon was introduced, the Athlon 64, which Intel simply didn't have an answer for, they took that those changes to heart, the competition, and they made tremendous products and jumps afterwards. I mean, the Pentium 3 was a really good product, especially when they went to Coppermine. You know, the Pentium 4 was pretty crappy, but the Core 2 Duo and the Conroe stuff, I mean, it just placed Intel so far ahead of everybody else. Then AMD had lots of stumbles, but we have not seen huge jumps in performance, core counts, anything since they introduced the original i7-920 and 940 and that generation of stuff. That was the basic model. You had at the top end 4 cores, 8 threads. And they have milked that and milked that and milked that. And sure, there have been some pretty decent iterations of products where we've seen a consistent increase in IPC, better power characteristics, you know, better clocking throughout time. But we've kind of been stuck in the same place for a while. And a lot of that is, I think it is basically leadership. You don't have the vision. You're enjoying the margins that you have without increasing your R&D when you think that, hey, you know, maybe things won't be going right in the future. Let's make sure and utilize some of this money we've been making and make sure we continue to be ahead of the competition. And instead, it seems like in between the bean counters and them just kind of saying, you know, AMD is 1/16 our size. There's no way that they could produce anything that is going to cause any issues for us or that we can't match in rather quick order. But now we've got this perfect storm of Ryzen is a really good design. AMD is leveraging Samsung and GlobalFoundries and TSMC to not only have solid products right now, but in the next year, in 2019, it's going to be even better because they will be utilizing a 7-nanometer product, probably from TSMC first. They may leverage GlobalFoundries later on. Samsung doesn't sound like they'll be doing that, but 7-nanometer TSMC on paper looks very, very similar to what Intel attempted to do with their 10-nanometer process. But when you throw in the other factors about what Intel threw into their 10-nanometer process, it really does seem to me it was a bridge too far. They just, and I mean, it's obvious now because it's not working as it should. It's not yielding as it should. The products that are coming off of it are not that impressive. And they're hurting. I mean, 2018 is good for them. I mean, they've reused the 14-nanometer process. They've added to it. It's you know, an iterative process. They're now, what, on 14-nanometer plus. And their margins are still great because they have a competitive product for 2018. We don't know what 2019 is going to bring at all. So, yes, I think the in-between manufacturing, leadership and vision, and you know, you can't argue that Intel is not doing well because they're doing extremely well. They have record after record quarter, and they're still going to do great throughout this year. They're going to do very good next year, even with these challenges. And I mean, they have done okay in widening their product base. They've kind of gotten out of mobile because they just didn't put the focus on competing with ARM that they probably should have. And now they I don't know, do they just feel like it's an area that is no longer viable? But it's such a huge market. And so maybe the board of directors is looking at this as like, you know, we don't like where we're going. Sure, things are good now, but looking down the lane, it's looking grim. And so, yes, having this come up is very convenient for the board and the shareholders, because you're not firing this guy for his performance.
Right.
And the things you're seeing down the road, it's because he had this consensual relationship while he's married and with another person at Intel. It is something they could, you know, get him to resign and say that. And if you notice their announcement, what was the second part of their announcement?
Well, the first part was that the resignation was accepted to show that, quote, all employees will respect Intel's values and adhere to the company's code of conduct, and that the board of directors has, quote, a robust succession planning process in place and has begun a search for a permanent CEO, including both internal and external candidates.
And then at the bottom of that, the forward-looking statements. Oh, by the way, our next quarter is going to be even stronger than even we thought.
Right.
Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
Yeah,
because we're going to be doing great.
And as you know, certainly Ryzen is a small chunk of the processor market at this point, but growing. And I think it's probably a huge chunk of the enthusiast market. But when you look at the 2017 financial results, $62.8 billion for the year, record fourth quarter revenue of $17.1 billion. Quote, excluding McAfee, fourth quarter revenue grew 8% year over year, with data-centric revenue up 21%. Full year revenue grew 9% year over year. That's huge numbers for a company this big. $22 billion in cash. From operations, returned nearly $9 billion to shareholders in 2017. They're raising their cash dividend to 10% for 2018. So there's no doubt whatever issues Intel has, and I think there's a lot of issues the farther down the road you look. They've certainly diversified in a lot of creative ways. They're bringing in revenue in a lot of places. Certainly we're not big fans of the desktop is dead. Laptops are for fools. You can do everything. You know, I watched a friend of mine edit a video and like a 7-minute video in 1080p on a phone. It can be done. It is a miserable experience. There's a lot of things that desktops and laptops do considerably better than mobile devices at this point, even if they're from Apple, no offense.
None taken.
iPad Pro users. Yeah, I think this was it kind of came out of nowhere, and I think it was really convenient for Apple to give Mr. Kazanich a chance to exit so they could figure out what comes next. I'm really curious to see what comes next.
I think somebody saw the bleeding and they were more than willing to step up and stop it as soon as possible. And Brian has done some interesting things. I mean, certainly bringing in Jim Keller and Raja Koduri, those were big and previously kind of unheard of steps. You just don't bring in people from other companies to work at Intel. I mean, you join Intel in your youth and you keep trying to stay employed. And eventually you're going to be getting into these bigger parts. So bringing in new blood is, it's a big deal. And, I think that was probably one of the bigger positives that Brian has left with that and is maybe a little bit more flexibility in how they do business. Right. And we'll see if that pays off.
Yeah. I would also be curious how much of 2017's numbers are due to stuff like memory. I mean, you know, when you look at that sort of investor relations statement I was quoting earlier about the money they made in 2017, strategic investments in memory, programmable solutions, communications, autonomous driving are starting to pay off and expand Intel's growth opportunity. I'm also really curious, as we watch NVIDIA and Intel and a whole bunch of startups inside or purchased by or outside of the automotive industry, just exactly how much money is it going to go into autonomous vehicles? Because everybody seems to be projecting that it's the growth opportunity of all growth opportunities. And I'm like, yeah, 300 million cars in the United States, a staggering number of delivery trucks and long haul trucks. I'll be really curious to see how many of those have actually been replaced by autonomous vehicles in 5 years.
I'm guessing not many, because the hurdles that they still face are tremendous. And even though we give these really nice videos from NVIDIA and others that, you know, say how close we are, now the reality is the amount of miles driven with autonomous and the amount of issues that they've had and stuff that we don't hear reported on and near misses and whatnot. I think it's still a long ways to go, and the computing power will get there sooner as opposed to later, but it's going to be the software side.
Yeah, I having seen here in the Bay Area, it's been several years, but I still remember the first time I saw one of the retrofitted vehicles, and the driver was, I want to say, on 80, and the driver was leaning back, arms crossed, wheel in front of them, and it was a real, like, this is the Jetsons, this is the future, and boy, you know, I can't get this networking thing that's supposed to be plug and play to work.
And you people are driving cars autonomously. Yeah. But going back to, oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, you know, and given the amount of security issues we've seen with significantly less complicated automotive interfaces, you know, it's one of the terrifying things at DEF CON. You know, I had a friend who was like, I just got this really awesome Bluetooth house lock. It uses the same technology as cars. And I'm like, oh, you need to take that off your door. He's like, but the company says, and I forwarded him a link from a DEF CON, and he's like, bought a new lock. It's not electronic. And that's going to be exciting when it comes to cars. You're starting to say
it is. Do you have any feeling about who Intel would get for the CEO position? I mean, do you think they're going to do internally? Do you think they're going to attempt to get somebody else externally? I mean, I'm not leaning towards external just because they've never done that before. But is this an opportunity? I don't think Raj is going to, you know, they're not going to get him because he just doesn't have enough time and enough executive experience at that level. But
he's got enough challenges dealing with getting his unit up and running and online and competing. You know, for me, not that anybody's ever going to mistake me for any sort of business writing expert, but it's been really fascinating to see the fallout or literally like General Electric, right, is off the Dow Jones. Was basically kicked off the Dow Jones in the last couple of weeks. And it's amazing that this company that was considered this bastion of superior management train wrecked itself, and, you know, for any of a number of complicated reasons, mostly involving, you know, banking or how they did banking or the entire, you know what I mean, like the whole that whole financial collapse, and apparently we don't need to be, you know, the banks will regulate themselves, please go about your business. You know, but to look at companies where they were all about management on so many levels and made a whole lot of money before the wheels fell off and there was this horrible grinding sound. I think of General Electric on that. So when I look at Intel, I think about this enormously complicated company with huge ingrained, you know, like what I like to call institutional memory. You know, there's the right way, the wrong way, the Army way, the Intel way. And we're going to do it the Intel way because this is Intel. And it's interesting to talk to people inside of that. You know, smaller units may not feel it more. People higher up in management may be a bigger part of that. But I'm very curious to see if they hire someone from outside or if they promote somebody internally. I'm really curious because there's, you know, it's a big, complicated company with tremendous challenges. I mean, who would you bring in? You know, I'm torn between the idea that, you know, management genius, and I'm thinking of like Jack Welch, you know, can do amazing things versus, you know, how much of so much of the management genius we've seen in a lot of publicly held companies seems to be about financial manipulation to make quarterly results look particularly spectacular to shareholders versus things that actually contribute to stable long-term growth of the company.
I think Brian was more of a product guy and not so much an engineer, and it seems like Intel probably had its most success when they actually had an engineer in there and, you know, someone who knows the very basics of their products. And, you know when you're looking at roadmaps and whatnot, you have a better idea of what is feasible, what is manufacturable, what can actually drive a profit, just a little bit more than some guy who who, you know, was in charge of products, who had these chips delivered to him, and he had to figure out how to productize them and whatnot, and you know, where they fit. But that's not a long-term idea of what's coming down the line. It's like you're handed a product that has been created and designed and over years and years, and you take that and then you bring it to market. But you know, at least knowing the basics and the physics behind it and understanding design and what it takes, I think that those, you know, for at least a company like Intel, they've got plenty of other smart financial people to back you up, but you got to have just that basis in understanding your product.
Well, understanding the future of your product. I mean, imagine, you know, imagine if, you know, 15 years ago, somebody at Intel had decided to kind of, or 10 years ago, if somebody at Intel had really decided that, you know, phones are going to be a lot bigger than anybody thinks they're going to be, you know, and force the company to, you know, hold on to its ARM license. You know, if they'd gotten much more serious, I think, about the mobile designs much earlier than they eventually did, you know,
Apple went to them initially. For a product for the iPhone, and Intel just kind of poo-pooed them off.
Yeah, I mean, that's truly one of the great business mistakes of all time. you know, it's easy to say that now, but I can also remember, like, I remember myself, like, somebody being like, you know what's going to be really big? Navigation on phones, and me being like, okay, and then 2 years later, me being like, wow. Note to
They're
self.
Right.
Yeah, they were incredibly right. Big changes coming in the gaming, the notebook or laptop markets. It's interesting. Asus, Tech, and MSI sell like half of the gaming notebooks. It's kind of crazy. Dell, HP, and Lenovo have realized that there's a lot of money to be made there. And based on conversations I've had, most of it is in the sort of, you know, $1,000, sub-$1,000 range. There's a huge, huge demand for that. Asus Tech has the, according to DigiTimes, Asus Tech is the number one seller in medium and high-tier gaming laptops, priced over $1,000 in 2017, like 20% of the global market. MSI is a big chump, and it's kind of crazy when you start looking at this. Asus Tech's ROG branded gaming notebook shipments are estimated at 600,000 units in the first half of 2018. MSI's lagging. Dell's picking up speed. I thought it was interesting to realize, one, how many gaming notebooks are actually sold annually. And, you know, Lenovo, which dominates apparently the inexpensive laptop or gaming laptop sales in China, is really gunning to increase their sales in the United States. They're expecting to sell 800 or 9,000 gaming laptops in 2018, almost entirely under $1,000. Acer is apparently going to ship like a 500,000. I just was amazed at how many people are actually buying gaming laptops. I thought that was kind of crazy.
I walked into a local Walmart, and here I am in Laramie, Wyoming, population 28,000 or some change. And they had an Anstan MSI gaming laptop. And I thought, I've never seen that here. Who would buy such a thing? But apparently there are quite a few people out there. And if you think Walmart, about it, I mean, it's got interesting looking design. It's not an average Dell or Lenovo, which kind of looks the same. I mean, it's got a little bit of flash, but not too much. But still, it's also a powerful enough laptop for any of your productivity stuff. It's got some extras in there that add, you know, value. And it had G-Sync on there as well, which And this is a $1,500 laptop, which is, you know, expensive for many people, but, you know, it's kind of packed with a lot of stuff. And they're selling it at Walmart in Laramie, Wyoming.
Well, it turns out, because I was talking to somebody who works on the marketing side of this, and it turns out Walmart's one of the primary channels for gaming laptop sales. And a bunch of the companies actually make specific models, as people do, they make very specific models for Walmart, for that channel. But I was amazed at how big one that Asus MSI sold like half of the gaming laptops. And then just to find out exactly how many were sold, just millions annually in the United States. And I was kind of surprised by that, or impressed by that, I guess. Good article up on Digitimes on that one if you're kind of curious about that. I should say this is actually global laptop sales, just not the United States. It's one of the last areas where they're seeing significant product growth compared to, say, traditional desktops or inexpensive laptops. So it's going to be a good year for gaming laptops, I think. And based on, like, Shannon did a review of one of the new, pardon me, excuse me as I try to swallow my own tongue. It was interesting. We were looking at an $850 Nitro 5 laptop, and it was crazy to realize that this thing is on sale for a biscuit under $700 at Best Buy right now. And that really, like, the Acer Aspire Nitro 5 with a Core i5 and a 1050 Ti, which is not spectacular gaming, but great, a solid 1080p gaming experience, and you're looking at like $650 if you get it on sale at Best Buy. That kind of blew my mind looking at
that.
Yeah,
it's cheap.
Would not want a big enough backpack to carry it, but not bad looking. If you want to see something crazy, like 19 gigabit per second transfer rates, PC Pro's got a link that you will probably want to be checking out. I'll just read the quote from the PC Pro article. Jeremy Hellstrom wrote up. it just blows my mind. To hit 19 gigabytes per second, you need to recreate, not gigabits, gigabytes per second. You need to create a RAID 0 array of 8 1-terabyte Western Digital Black NVMe SSDs, but you can't use the motherboard's RAID feature because you would be limited by the 32 gigabit per second, 4 gigabyte per second DMI bottleneck. And this is sort of the ultimate death raid. Not just RAID 0, but RAID 0 with 8 drives. So it's like $3,200
worth of failure.
High. Yeah. I mean, and this is $3,200 worth of SSDs plus a pair of Asus Hyper M.2 expansion cards. Tech ARP has a look at how Andrew Vogue pulled that one off. I just had to say that because I just thought it was staggeringly awesome and slightly terrifying. And
I'm hoping that AMD gets kind of their stuff together when it comes to NVMe and their CPUs, because they've got Threadripper, so many PCIe lanes that are just begging to be utilized for storage solutions like this. I mean, it's not much of a solution, but if you want really, really, and you need really, really fast writes, and you don't care about sustainability of the integrity of what you're doing, that's just awesome.
Just automate your backups. That's all I'm going to say. One last thing before we thank our sponsor, real short. U.S. Supreme Court ruled this morning that states have broad authority to collect sales taxes from online retailers. So if you currently enjoy a sales tax-free buying experience, which if you're shopping at places other than, say, Amazon.com, you probably do, you can expect your state to start gunning for that tax revenue. How that's going to happen, of course, is an entirely different conversation, but expect billions to be collected. And it's, a lot of people also don't realize, for example, here in the state of California, while you can purchase online without paying sales tax, you do have to report and pay that state sales tax in your annual tax refund. They have an honor system for that one.
What is this state income tax that you're talking about?
Oh, no, not income. Let me put it to you this way. What's the property tax in the state of Wyoming?
It's pretty low. And there's no individual income tax for one of many reasons why I live here, except, of course, the 8 months of aforementioned winter that we suffered.
I was going to say, do you save more? It would be interesting to look at the cost of heating in winter versus the cost of income tax in the state of California for a Wyoming-California comparison. But yeah, it's I mean, do you think Wyoming, for example, or Texas are going to go after income or not income tax or are going to go after sales tax for online sales?
It wouldn't shock me just because online sales have impacted local business so much. I mean, sure, you have your Walmarts and whatnot, but small sports business in town. One just recently sold down here, and you walk in and they have a third less stuff on hand that you would usually see or you had saw a year ago, just because it's so much easier to go to an outlet store that are 60, 100 miles away, or just order online and have it delivered in your house in 2 days. Mm-hmm. So I think that it will make them more competitive. And, mm-hmm. Local businesses, I mean, there's positives to it. I mean, it's part of the workforce. It's just keeping money in a community, right? And, actually grabbing some money from the community. I mean, because, Laramie, a lot of people visit. But I think, it's government regulation. So there's two feelings there. Some of it is good protectionism, and some of it is, why are you telling me what to do?
Yeah. I should also point out that in the state of Texas, quote, a taxable item that is shipped from outside the state directly to a Texas customer is subject to Texas use tax at the location where the customer takes delivery. Use tax rates are the same as sales tax rates. That's straight from comptroller.texas.gov. So, oh my goodness. We should take a moment to thank our sponsor. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage, by Quicken Loans. Mortgage experience, it's horrible. It's scary, right? I'm taking on a 15, 30-year loan, be paying all this money. And then all of a sudden it feels like 1985. Or, if you're younger, 2005. Like the internet doesn't exist and computers are something that are locked behind a room. It's the whole mortgage experience. It needed to be focused on you. It needed a technological revolution, which is why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage to give you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It makes it simple. You get to fully understand all the details. Be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient, right? You've got your financial information inside of Quicken. Trusted partners, everything's set up. You can share that information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. It's powerful. Doesn't matter if it's your first home, your 10th. Rocket Mortgage can perform thousands of calculations in seconds, do the math for you, so you can really know what's going on. What is this whole thing? If I take a point, if I do this, if I do that, if the interest rate goes up, the interest rate goes down, how much does it really cost me? Over a 30-year mortgage, it could be a lot of money. And it's nice to have a tool that can help you figure that out. Based on your income, your assets, your credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify, help you find the one that's right for you. A little help when you're getting the mortgage would be nice. Because most of the people trying to sell you a mortgage aren't really looking out for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/twit. That's rocketmortgage.com/TWIT. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030. And we want to thank Rocket Mortgage for their sponsorship of This Week in Computer Hardware and Twit. Oh, my goodness.
Such nice people to be supporting such drivel from me.
Well, it is nice of them. I don't know. I was laughing as a friend of mine was like, I don't care if my financial advisor is a fiduciary. And I'm like, really? I just want to say that. Because it's still one of the funniest things I've heard in a really long time.
Yeah.
So you want someone who can legally fleece your ass. And he was like, no. I'm like, do you understand what a fiduciary is? I do not think this word means what you think it means. Sorry, been on a Princess Bride kick lately. AMD dropped by PC Per to talk about FreeSync for HDR, FreeSync for TVs, variable refresh rate, the future. FreeSync 2, if you
yes.
will.
Electric Boogaloo.
We're starting to see some kind of early FreeSync reviews showing up, or FreeSync 2-ish reviews. Whether or not they're actual real products, I think, depends on where you're looking. But any big takeaways from that? Any big exciting news that kind of struck you out of that conversation?
It's FreeSync 2, HDR is one. They want a minimum HDR 600, I think, is the spec. But I think the bigger news is that they're kind of enforcing, maybe not enforcing, but more, okay, enforcing, but requiring to have more set minimum and variable refresh things. So you can't, you know, say this is FreeSync 2 and you have just a super tiny slice of frames that support that. You know what? What am I trying to say? Sometimes
they don't want it to be. Well, we've seen like VESA has HDR specs, and the entry level of HDR specs are certainly better than a traditional monitor, but aren't even remotely close to sort of the top HDR spec from VESA is pretty impressive. The entry level, the 400, is not so impressive. And what's really depressing is that entry level spec, in many cases, is delivering better HDR performance than the majority of HDR televisions sold in like 2016 or 2017. But it seems like AMD, especially looking at like ratings, the website rtings.com, we talked about this last week, Samsung televisions are the first AMD Radeon FreeSync televisions. And I think what you're trying to say is that AMD is trying to make sure that this is actually valuable and useful and not just another checkbox feature on the box.
Yeah, because so say, for instance, some of the older monitors, they would have a variable refresh spectrum or zone of like 45 to 75 frames per second or hertz. And then, any place above that, things just kind of break down or don't work. And so, you know, the thinner this area, the harder it is to get your graphics subsystem to consistently pump out frames, so you get the positive benefits of the variable refreshing. But it's hard to do. And so I think AMD is pushing to have a little bit wider gamut of these numbers and to have some minimum specifications to do. So like if you've got a minimum of 40 and you go all the way to 144 hertz, I mean, you're hitting pretty much all use case scenarios. I mean, you're going to have that nice, smooth gameplay, non-tearing, pretty much no matter what graphics you have, because, you know, anything under 40, they're going to do, frame doubling, and it's going to still hit that sweet spot, which is huge. But say, like, if you have 45 to 60, well, if you've got a 43 frames per second, well, you can't double that, because it's going to be that double is going to be well outside of the spec. So they are tightening up all the specifications, it seems like, you know, with FreeSync to making things a little bit easier for consumers to think that, hey, this is going to work out in the situations that I'm going to put it through, and it's going to work out very, very well. Once we get more FreeSync two stuff in. I know that there's a couple of strange little if and or buts about it. Mm-hmm. Like one of the products has a range that only goes from like 120 to 144, and then it has a different mode for anything kind of outside of that. And so, you know, we're going to be doing a lot of work with these in the next couple of months, and it's going to be interesting to see. I mean, you know, G-Sync is still kind of the class leader in terms of the support and the quality of the product that they put out. But again, it comes at a huge price increase. I mean, $100, $200, $300 per monitor that you're going to absorb just to get G-Sync. But at the same time, G-Sync has got a broader feature set than what even FreeSync 2 HDR has, but mm-hmm. we're going to be going into more of these things, I would imagine, very soon.
Something we're not going to be seeing a lot of in the future is Xbox One support of VR or mixed reality. E3 last week. Well, there it's right there. If you're looking at that CNET article on the page, the Xbox One won't support VR because Microsoft broke its promise. A bummer for virtual reality enthusiasts, Marianne Zhu wrote that up for CNET.com. Gamesindustry.biz has a fantastic article. It gets pretty deep on Xbox's strategies. They sat down with Chief Marketing Officer Mike Nichols, Brendan Sinclair from over at gamesindustry.biz, which is a pretty intense website if you're into the gaming. But if you take a look at that, really simple quote, "We don't have any plans specific to Xbox consoles and virtual reality or mixed reality. Our perspective on it has been and continues to be that the PC is probably the best platform for more immersive VR and MR. As an open platform, it allows faster, more rapid iteration. There are plenty of companies investing in the hardware side and the content side or some combination therein. Obviously on phones, augmented reality is a good scenario as well that's going to grow. But as it relates to Xbox, no. Our focus is primarily on experiences you would play on your TV, and ultimately we'd like to make those experiences more broadly." And, you know, I would like to point out that PlayStation VR does seem to be fairly successful, but will not be.
But I think Sony spent a lot of money to make it successful. And plus, with the latest PS4 Pro, it's a significantly faster machine than, you know, the Xbox One.
Yeah,
You know, faster than the Xbox One S, and just right up there with the new Xbox One X. Yeah, but yeah, I think that they probably look at the performance and look at the things they got to do on the software side and the development to get it to work like they want to. Mm-hmm. I think that's a pretty significant hurdle, and Sony took it, but I think that they paid for it, and they've been working on this VR stuff for, you know, quite some time on their end.
But you're looking at like 100 games. Man, they had 100 games on PlayStation VR back in 2015. You know, there's a Doom VFR bundle, Elder Scrolls 5, Gran Turismo. I don't know. I think it's probably not good for VR that Xbox basically decided they don't care. But there are lots of other exciting things in the VR world. I'm very curious to see where the Oculus Go ends up and some of the next generation Daydream stuff, especially as we wait for the new chipsets that are VR focused to come out. One last story before we go, because I know you've got a hard out. As we ease towards August and Black Hat and DEF CON, this has me thinking terrifying thoughts. NFC digital car key spec for smartphones. Mac Rumors had a nice write-up on this. The Car Connectivity Consortium, which includes Apple, Audi, BMW, General Motors, Hyundai, LG Electronics, Panasonic, Samsung, Volkswagen, Alps Electric, Continental Automotive, Denso, Gemalto, NXP, Qualcomm, a pretty big list. You know, not all of them, but a pretty big list. Like, you know, I don't see Honda in there. I don't see Toyota in there. I don't see Ford in there. But essentially, they've come out with the Digital Key Release 1.0, which essentially means using NFC on your smartphone as a digital key to access your vehicle. So, and if you've never heard of the Car Connectivity Consortium, you're probably not alone listening to this podcast. Organization focused on enabling seamless mobile device to vehicle connectivity, which kind of brings us back to the whole automotive security thing. I don't know. You'll be able to lock, unlock, start the engine, and share access to the car, which is an interesting. That's the one where I get kind of fascinated, like the idea that you can keep little Jimmy from taking the car on Saturday night, or reward little Jimmy, even if you're traveling on business.
Well, I mean, they've got to be a way to give it to the valet without giving them your phone.
Yeah. Well, that'll be that.
Not that I ever use valets a lot, but still, yeah.
I was going to say, I've been to Laramie. There's valet parking.
No. You can park anywhere because there's not many people.
This is actually a very positive thing, because there is nowhere left to park during the day in Oakland or San Francisco at this point. Digital key provisioning, digital key revocation, selling the vehicle, remote and peer-to-peer digital key sharing, restricting usage. They're so excited about this. The part that I love, there was so much excitement around it. Mac Rumors observes that the CCC has begun working on a digital key 2.0 specification. that will actually ensure interoperability between different smart devices and vehicles. And that's going to be that spec will be completed Q1 2019. So I don't know.
I understand how easy it is to copy a key, you know, old style.
Yeah.
Or, you know, pick a lock and, you know, smash their ignition, and, you know, like in the movies, because it's so accurate. But I mean, it's opening up another avenue that previously was not there for a smart criminal to get your stuff.
Radio lets hackers steal cars with just $20 worth of gear. Keeping your car safe from electronic thieves. Smart key systems are increasingly a target for car thieves. Here's how to protect your car from that scary key fob attack. Fact check, code grabbers, and remoteless keyless entry on Snopes.com. Relay car theft of keyless entry car rises. So, you know.
You know, if somebody can design something, then obviously someone can
reverse engineer it.
Can change that. Yeah. Get to figure out what makes it tick. And there's nothing perfect out there.
Nope. But boy, there's a lot of highly motivated people to break into things. I mean, here in San Francisco, we have some of the worst car break-in rates in the United States. But they're not actually bothering to do, you know, any sort of remote fob key theft. They just actually have cars that look for a particularly likely candidate. And that car drives around, and the partner gets out of the car, breaks the window, grabs everything they can grab, hops back into the car or in a following car, and then disappears. And it's actually it's a really severe problem in some of the more touristy areas, like up in Coit Tower and stuff. But San Francisco, with its population of 875,000-ish, certainly well under a million, has as many or more break-ins as Los Angeles or New York, who both have somewhere like around 13 to 15 times as many citizens. So don't leave stuff in your car. And if your car is gone in the morning, you should have put your key fob in the freezer.
Yeah.
Before you go, anything you're excited about? Anything you've been testing at home? Anything you're ogling while you're rolling through Amazon contemplating purchasing, or are you just over technology at this point?
You know, yesterday they had the Z906, the Logitech Z906 home theater 5.1, except it's, you know, it's computer based, and that was for $199, and it's usually $400, and it's still on sale for today for $295. But boy, that $199 price point for a newer set of speakers than what I've got here. I think I can't remember which model I have, but it's one of the previous big Logitech 5.1. Something like it's got a 10-inch woofer in the bass unit, and you know it has been such a wonderful setup for my computer audio and watching movies while I'm here and just, you know, listening to music. It's been fantastic, but it's also 13 years old, I think. It's not a spring chicken when it comes to a speaker system. And boy, it sure has. But yeah, I was looking at that and thinking, that'd be nice to have. But in the end, I was happy with what I had. Otherwise, I'm trying to set up a Ryzen Plus system, a 2000 series. It's a 2600. Nice. Z or K X, no X. And, you know, that is just a really neat overall processor. And I'm looking forward to, you know, the last AMD machine that I worked with was an FX 8350 based AM3, you know, plus.
It's been a while.
It's been a long time. So it's going to be fun to do that this weekend and kind of get into the nuts and bolts of it. So I'm excited.
I've got an 1800X that I picked up when they launched them last year. And outside of being really irritated by the price drop between last year and this year, it's been, it's a beast. Rendering video on that is just one of my favorite things ever. So just he's like, goes. Is it really that much faster? Well, I went from, I want to say like 100 frames per second to 145 frames per second on a handbrake.
That's pretty serious.
That's a pretty serious increase. Yeah, multi-threaded performance. You know, I'm not sweating individual core performance, but you know, it allowed me to, you know, throw vastly more cores than I could have afforded on the Intel side of the fence at video.
And my other job, I'm a sysadmin for a statistics firm, and we needed a high end kind of just computation, heavy duty computation needs that you know involved in R and statistics, and I convinced them to try out a Threadripper, and it's a 16 core, and we put 128 gigs of memory in it, and you know 32 threads, and I mean these people just abuse the living crap out of it, but it holds up, and I was running benchmarks on that thing before. I mean it is a big step above anything else that you could get on the desktop at the time when it was first released. And, you know, certainly Intel has kind of come back with some competing parts, but still, you know, that Threadripper with the 32 threads for the price that you get that for, it's phenomenal. If you do any kind of video editing, just get that. Be happy.
Just get all the cores.
Yeah.
All of them. Every single one. Oh, my goodness. Ladies and gentlemen, that's Mr. Josh Wall with PCPerd.com. You can find him mangling his editing, his quote, not mine. He's also in Wyoming, so I feel safe that he can't hit me through the internet, at least not until Web 4.0. You can find him over at PCPerd.com. He's a regular contributor. You can find him on the PCPerd podcast. And thank you so much for covering for Ryan while he goes on his great basketball adventure in New York City. So many odd thoughts.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Oh, thanks so much for making it. If this is your first episode of This Week in Computer Hardware, please go to twit.tv/twitch. You get links on how to download it on your favorite podcaster, and you get all of the older episodes. So do yourself a favor and go check that out. My name is Patrick Norton. You can find me over at tekthing.com, a weekly show I do with Shannon Morris about technology. We answer some viewer questions, and yes, we did that Nitro 5 gaming laptop, and we got really serious about figuring out how to block spam calls for a viewer this week. And boy, it turns out that's an interesting thing to do. And I also do a show called AV Excel with Robert Herron, where we talk about home theater and audio gear. And hope you'll check that out. With that, ladies and gentlemen, come back, join us next week. I'm Patrick Norton.
And I'm Josh Walrath.
We'll catch you next week on Twitch.